Rasa. Welcome back to Spaced Out Audios. This podcast is intended with the mission to inform, inspire, and educate members of the Greater East Side of Los Angeles. My mission is to promote cultural autonomy while exploring my passion for community engagement, utilizing the arts and the amazing network I've had the pleasure of building over the years. And yeah, before we get into it, I did want to acknowledge the space I'm recording in, and that's Espacio 1839. They are a community-based store for apparel and books representing cultures in Boyle Heights, plus a booth for community radio. That is where we're recording from. And they're located down the street from Mariachi Plaza on 1st Street. Without further ado, I'm going to welcome my guest, my first guest on the podcast. Professor Robert Cristo is an indigenous historian and Latin Americanist whose research centers on Chicano, Chicana, Chicanx themes of resistance and rebellion. Professor Cristo, welcome.
Hello, hello, hello.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to have this guest. He's a good friend of mine. And let's see what unravels. So, Professor Cristo, let's get to know you a little bit.
All right. So my name is Professor Robert Cristo. I am a professor at the Los Angeles Community College District. I teach history, Chicano studies, Latin American studies, history, political science. If it's a little crazy, I'm probably going to be there.
Can you talk about the path towards becoming a professor? You're a Chicano. So, your backstory is pretty interesting, if you want to touch on that a little bit. But well, yeah, how are you?
Well, the professor? In short pathway to becoming a professor is don't drop out. That's the big thing. You got to stick with school. But in terms of my pathway, I like to credit two spaces. First, I like to credit Dr. Malina Abdullah. She's one of the leaders of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles in 2014, 2015. That's a while ago now. But back at that time, I was very active in the streets. And at that time, we were protesting heavily against police violence and working alongside different organizations, one of the main ones, of course, being BLMLA. That opportunity allowed me to really see firsthand what a scholar activist looks like, what a scholar activist can do, and the power that they can have in a social movement. So that scholar activist, of course, was Dr. Malina Abdullah. And at the time, she was the chair of Pan-African Studies at Cal State Los Angeles. And again, being around her, seeing her leadership propelled me to want to apply and continue on with my education. At the time, I had had a BA from Whittier College, but again, seeing her led me to explore a master's. I ended up going into Latin American studies, also at Cal State LA. I really wanted to learn from her and really be in her classroom. From there, I learned of the second place I pulled from for inspiration, and that's the work of Dr. Angela Davis. So Angela Davis is the queen legend of all scholar activists. She is still in the front line. She was in the front lines back when the Panthers were a thing. And again, she's still out there now. So seeing her her model of her leadership and her image again propelled me not only to, again, complete my master's, but move further to get a PhD. And that's where I am right now. And that's what allows you to teach in college.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm just curious to know how you intend to teach. What is your methodology going to be like? If it's different from what you've experienced, you know, what kind of experience do you hope to give your future students?
So I'm very lucky in that I have different experiences to pull from. So let me start with my undergrad. So Whittier College is very much a traditional university in the sense that they're going to grill you, they're going to put you through it, you're going to be reading, you're going to be writing. And as much as I like to credit and say I learned from that, and I did, I really learned a lot, but I will feel that really it wasn't as accessible. I think students, especially students in my cohort who didn't have a lot of the support that I had, really weren't able to acclimate themselves or really weren't able to meet the requirements, and a lot of them got pushed out of the college or pushed out of college. One of the things we don't talk about really is college pushout, the amount of raza that gets into universities, go to universities, but without the support, without the resources, they're not able to make it. So Whittier was a great experience. I learned a lot, but I really had to keep in it myself again to not get pushed out. So I'm branching that experience or pairing that experience with my other experience at Cal State Los Angeles when I did my master's. And now that was a total opposite. Cal State LA is really like the true Chicano university. When we think of HBCUs or historically black universities, Cal State Los Angeles is the one, if not the 100% for sure, historic brown university that we have. So when I was at Cal State LA, it was a major difference. I went from seeing at Whittier a lot of white classmates who would say very racist things in classroom, a lot of teachers that would have racist opinions, and it was very much a racial battleground in addition to an educational space. Whereas Cal State LA was home. It was nothing but raza. It was nothing but POC. Even if they weren't down with us, like, I'll be real, the business department, those cats really weren't too fans of us in ethnic studies. But those of us in King Hall at the, again, LAS, Latin American Studies, PAS, Pan-African Studies, Chicano Studies, I think that's CHS, we were all together and we were all writing for each other. And again, this was the, you know, heat of the movement. We were doing walkouts. We were protesting on campus, taking space. So that really showed me what support looks like, what a real learning community could look like, something that where you didn't have to keep your guard up when you were in the classroom or when you were on campus, where you can really breathe easy and share ideas and explore new thought and new spaces. Moving from that to where I want to be as an educator, and I'll say, because I know I haven't really talked too much about Claremont, Claremont is very similar to Whittier in the idea that this is really a high-level academic institution that is, how should I put this, great because you learn a lot, but at the same time, it's on you to make it, right? Now, pulling that all together to what I want to do, my methodology, when I am a professor in the classroom, is I really want to balance both spaces. I want to balance accessibility with the best quality of education possible. I think that's a challenge, and every class is going to present a different challenge or a different dynamic that requires me to make the balance. For example, there might be a really, really good book, right? The best book on a subject. This is the one you have to read to know. But the problem might be is that book might be written in a highly academic language where unless you've already had a BA and then some, you wouldn't be able to understand the paragraph. Or that book might be extremely expensive and hard to get. So those are issues of access. So what's the point of assigning a great book if no one can get it or no one can understand it? At the same time, you don't want to do the opposite where you are now picking books that are essentially dumbed down or books that are subpar, right? Because you want to make sure everyone has total access. So I feel you have to have a middle space. And again, that is really dependent on the situation that you're in. But yes, if I'm going to go methodology, it's really balancing between accessibility and high level of education.
The way that sounds like the Chicano identity. You know, yeah, I mean, what I think about the Chicano identity is that third space in which, as my former Metcha advisor loves to state, is being Chicana is what you make it. And hearing that from a amazing Chicana scholar, professor, is very inspiring to me. And I did want to talk about how you and I met. That'd be really funny to get into. So do you want to tell it? Should I?
Well, the way I remember it is, for a time, I was tutoring coordinator at a great organization called Legacy LA or Legacy Los Angeles, which is a nonprofit community center that serves the Ramona Gardens or the Hazard community in Boyle Heights. And I was doing my thing, monitoring the tutoring space, helping students that needed help, of course. And my friend or soon to be friend, Samantha, shows up. And
I came in with a book in my hand and you're like, I know that book. And
she asked me about Saul Alinsky, and I'm like, how do you know who Saul Alinsky is? Because that's a rough cut. There might be a lot of cats out there who don't quite know who Saul Alinsky is, and that's why he's a rough cut. So Saul Alinsky wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. And why that matters to us as Chicanos is one of the organizations that was very important to the Chicano movement that really doesn't get a lot of fame is CSO, or the Community Service Organization. So CSO had a lot of organizers who had really come out of the labor movement, and they were trying to take what they had learned doing union work with labor organizations or workers essentially, and they wanted to take that and really bring it to the community. We're talking about community organizing, but really a real early precursor to community organizing, really like the foundation of community organizing. And a lot of them were trained by, or not trained directly by Saul Alinsky, but they were influenced by Saul Alinsky, influenced by his book Rules for Radicals. And so they really distributed that book and really put that book into the Chicano community through CSO. And now, what is it, 60 years later, that book is still, in a sense, relevant in terms of if you're a Chicano y Chicana and you're trying to activate or organize or give somebody some training, a book, a really old classic you could pull from is Sal Alinsky.
Yeah, I was carrying that book around with me. I got it from the Chicano Resource Center, and that's how we met.
Earlier, you mentioned that when you were starting high school, you, like many others around you, didn't really see the need for college or the need to go there. Why do you think Raza or young Raza feel that way?
I would say because we're raised by working parents, parents who sacrifice their time, their energy, and if we're speaking about mothers, their emotional labor among various kids. So in my experience, I grew up very dysfunctional. I had no time to really think about, what's my future path to college look like, when I was dealing with a lot of anxious energy and a lot of mental health issues around my family. So there was just no time, space to think about that. When I think about my experience going to school in East Los Angeles, I will say I was typically the student who was kicked out of class, who was sent to the dean's office, mostly just for being outspoken. And so I think that relationship with school made me feel like, okay, is there something wrong with me wanting to explore my ideas? Over time, I recognized, okay, well, nobody's going to push me to go.
But see, that's very indicative, right? That's very telling, right? That when it comes to our young raza, right, our young people in schools, they feel like they're the problem. They feel like it's something about their behavior that might have led to their problems when it comes to pursuing higher education, or that they're forced, right, to mitigate dysfunction at home, balance that with an education, and then somehow are assumed to be able to thrive on their own strength. And in reality, they're what, 14, 15, 16, if that? So we're really asking young people to navigate both pressure at home, pressure at school, and then if they don't do it as successfully as we'd like them to do it, we're going to tell them how it's all their fault. See, that's the problem. And that, again, is really what the Chicano movement was against. Dysfunction, unfortunately, due to colonialism, which, again, has been a process 500 years in running, right? So for 500 years, we've had dysfunctional homes, unfortunately, right? For 500 years, we've had students, our youth, right, with a difficult relationship with education. But the Chicano movement, again, 60 years, was really to fight those things, right? To give our students resources, to give our students and our youth the support they need. So it's very telling, unfortunately, that a youth, well, it's been a minute since you were a youth like that, but a recent youth in 2024 still has to go through those pressures that somebody just like her would have experienced in 1894.
Wow. I'll also add to the conversation that having... what I do remember from my high school experience was having a 60-to-1 ratio in my art class. And things like art, things like band got me coming to school, kept me coming to school, held me accountable from going to school. And yeah, I had an art class with 59 peers and one art teacher. And I don't know, I didn't see any quality. That was one class, yeah.
59 and one teacher.
60
and one teacher. I can't even remember 35 names, and that's just me throwing a big number out there. Could you imagine, anybody listening to this, try to remember 60 people and know their name, their progress, their grades, where they are? Good luck, right? So, and again, I think this is the big problem, is the system likes to put the onus on the youth, right? This idea of accountability, but what we're really thinking about right now is unmeasured accountability, irresponsible accountability. Why are we asking youth, children, to shape their own lives in a way that their parents weren't able to, and their parents before them weren't able to, when we as adults who have already had life experience should be the one being there to help them, right? To mitigate those disparities, right? To give them the edge that they didn't have. I think the problem, or one of the problems is there's too much of us, especially those of my generation who've been through it, are very quick to say, I did it. Nobody helped me. I made it. With this idea that their one story, right, as an individual can speak for the whole general raza, when you don't know other people's pressures. And to be honest, how do we know, again, these people who say, I made it, why can't them? We don't, or you don't know what kind of help you had. Everybody does it with help. And I think that there is not a refusal, but there's a code of, you got to do it yourself, that really makes help difficult, right? Or makes students have to be in charge of getting the help themselves. And I get it. You know, we want our students to be active participants in their own life, but we also shouldn't guilt them for being young and wanting to do what young people want to do. You ask a 14-year-old to make big life decisions, right? And normally, right, legally, in most cases, we won't ask a 14-year-old to make life decisions, but yet we're totally comfortable with somebody who's 14 years old dropping out. We're totally comfortable with somebody who's 14 making a decision that leads to them being incarcerated. So hearing your story, Sam, just reminds me again, really, of the role elder Chicanos, and not just elder meaning like older veterano Chicanos, elder, I mean like Chicanos who've just already made it out of high school, turning around, looking at the freshmen coming in and saying, hey, how can I help you make it to where I am today? And in so forth, right? The Chicanos who are graduating from college, looking at their freshmen saying, how can I help you make it till I or make it to where I am today? And then finally, the Chicanos in grad school who shouldn't think that, who shouldn't be too big to do this, turn around and go all the way back to Chicano youth, Chicanas, and say, hey, how do I get you here? Because again, we don't got the numbers there. We are still a decimal percentage in higher education, a decimal percentage in professional degrees. We got too many nurses and not enough doctors. Our illustrious host is really getting into her own academic career. So what pushes you to want to take that extra step and go to the university level where others would just stop at community college?
I'll say that I have a pretty cool mentor who pushes me and does not let me stop thinking about college. So I do appreciate that, because I will say growing up, I had no care for whatever happens after high school. Whatever happens, happens. That was my mindset until I was pushed out of high school. And yeah, just wondering, floating about life and thinking about, okay, well, what is going to motivate me? I mean, I've always been passionate about art and community, but I recognize that in order to discuss art and community, you kind of need credibility. I figured too that, you know, I'm a very social person, I'm a social learner, so if I put myself back out into continuation school, I could thrive, achieve my GED. And luckily that happened right as the pandemic was hitting. I love telling the story, it's so funny. I turned in my very last assignment and the teacher told me, hey, don't come back. You know, we're on lockdown. Good luck, whatever happens next. I will say they did provide a path for myself. They offered a scholarship at Abraham Friedman, which is a technical trade school in downtown LA. And although that was a pretty appealing option, pandemic changed many things, including that scholarship, because it would have been a scholarship. And who knows, maybe I would have been doing construction.
So there's a couple things there. There's a couple things there. Let's start first. Let me start with the one that's actually sticking in my head. They sent you to a trade school?
Yeah, so they developed a really good relationship, and although they did, you know, suggest go to community college,
they just weren't going to help you with that, though. They wanted you to do the trade school.
Well, that was an option on the table that was totally free. Another option they presented us was becoming a TSA at LAX.
At LAX, yeah. Okay, hold on. What trade? So let's just say in an alternate universe, you went to trade school.
I did attend a couple classes. I attended some graphic design classes, and I would have gotten a certificate. However, as I was joining, the professor was just leaving, so it made it really awkward. What they did also offer that I'm open to is construction, electrician. See. They also had barber shops. Then they also had auto.
Let me just put a pin in that. We fought too hard for our raza to go to trade school. Like, this is exactly what the Chicano movement was against. We need raza in college, right? We need a raza getting high-level degrees. We do not have the percentages of raza in high-level degrees. We are still in decimals when it comes to raza with high-level degrees. We do not need our institutions turning our young people to go to trade school. Like, don't get me wrong. There are people that are highly skilled in trades. They do very well for themselves in trades and all the power to them. However, when we think of our young people, we need to send them to college first and then let them decide if they want to go to trade school. Where it sounds like, for your experience, sounds like they were pushing you to trade school and it was college if you really wanted to do it, which is really unfair when you think about how youth, especially youth of color, don't really see college already as a future for them.
Something I wanted to bring up in conversation with you is the discussion of Chicano teatro and activism, the role it served. I love Chicano teatro and seeing the process in which a problem is introduced, a solution is hinted, and there's satire to make the problem less sad, real. That's my take a little bit on Chicano teatro, but I'd love to hear your take on Chicano teatro over the years.
So there's a scene in the first Harry Potter movie for all my nerds out there. So in Harry Potter, there's a scene where young Harry is talking to Hagrid, who's like a family friend, and Hagrid tells Harry, don't you want to know where your family learned it all? And he's like, learned what? And they're talking about magic. But for me, I always think of that scene in terms of how the Chicano movement really came into being. Where did the Chicano generation, which are the leaders that we think of in the Chicano movement, where did they learn it all, right? Where did they figure these practices? Because these practices didn't come from nowhere, right? We didn't wake up one morning and know how to be activists and know how to be organizers. So Chicano teatro is very interesting because you can kind of point to where Chicano teatro kind of started or where its trajectory comes from. Teatro really is a Latin American protest form. So this goes beyond Aslan, beyond the North, right? We're talking about Latin America, Central America, South America. And we're really talking about the work of a guy named Augusto Ball. Augusto Ball writes a book called Theater of the Oppressed. And it's really like a guide. Well, I shouldn't say a guide, but it really puts out the ideas, right? This idea of why is theater important? Why is theater important to people who are oppressed, and how could theater be a form of activism in itself? And the reason why is because theater does not require literacy, right? You don't have to have a certain level of education to understand theater, at least community theater, right? So when it comes to trying to organize a population, organize them around issues, and really make them connect to the issues that they're organizing against or for, theater is a great mechanism, right? You could go, you can watch it, you can empathize, you can see yourself with those who are on stage, and then hopefully that propels you to some sort of political action. Now, for Chicano theater, right, we're talking about Luis Valdez. And so Luis Valdez, and it must be understood, and I can't speak directly to how much Luis Valdez personally read about Latin America, but what I can say is that those of his generation like him, probably him, but those of his generation, they were reading what was going on in Latin America. One of the things that we don't like mentioning or is not often mentioned is how much the Chicano movement was connected to what was going on in Latin America. You know, Che Guevara got on the signs for a reason, right? People in Aslan were looking and seeing what was going on in Cuba, what was going on in Guatemala, what was going on in Brazil. So from this, you have Chicanos who are pooling, right, from Latin America. So you have Luis Valdez as an example, pooling, right, from this Latin American theater tradition, right, Theater of the Oppressed, and then taking this, right, to the farm workers, right, to Delano, to the Central Valley, to McFarland, to all the towns and the cities, right, or little cities that are right there in the farms. And because, again, you have a population that is rural, Luis Valdez couldn't go and give everybody a test to see where they were and what they could understand for pamphlets, right? And again, even if he did, you don't want to be so as exclusive that you could risk losing people, especially when you're trying to organize a mass movement. Let's put into context, Luis Valdez was doing this work in support of the UFW, that Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta. But to do this work, right, to help organize the farm workers, he was putting theater together, right, putting shows together. He was having campesinos, right, farm workers be actors, right, be writers, be a part of their own narrative. And by seeing their narrative on stage, it organized them again to do those strikes, to do those marches, right, to make those sacrifices. So Chicano theater has a very strong legacy that I think when we see it on a flyer, we don't immediately recognize.
Well said. And to go back to the first question you asked me about my educational path, I will say what does motivate me is speaking or finding the language to describe the unincorporated community I come from. And I feel like that's always been something I've been trying to put vocabulary to. Only this time I'm able to hone into my passion for love of community and arts and connection. And yeah, I think going the educational path and allowing myself to envision a future I literally never thought I'd experience live. Like right now, it's still a couple months away, but moving forward, I am pretty confident and I feel ready, you know, going to ELAC and doing the program I did, which was the Museum Studies program. It felt very intersectional and challenging and also just affirming to my own practice that I'm developing. So yeah, shout out my mentor. I appreciate them. We are reaching the end.
Thank you so much, Professor Cristo. As we check out, I want to thank you all for listening. And come back next week as we discuss more exciting things about being spaced out and a down space. Okay, thank you.